Jared was glad about this. He doubted the tiny ion engines would have been able to stop the sled before it would have wandered into the ring system and squashed him into a tumbling rock. "Private Dirac," Jared heard, as a verification key pinged his brain pal. "Yes," he said. "This is Captain Martin," Jared heard. "Welcome to Omaha. Please be patient. We're coming to get you." "If you send me directions, I could come to you," Jared said. "We'd rather you didn't," Martin said. "The Oban have been scanning the area more than usual recently. We'd prefer not to give them anything to see. Just sit tight." A minute or so later, Jared noticed three of the ring's rocks moving slowly his way. "It looks like I've got some debris headed toward me," he sent to Martin. "I'm going to maneuver out of the way." "Don't do that," Martin said. "Why not?" Jared asked. "Because we hate chasing after shit," Martin said. Jared directed his unitard to focus on the incoming rocks and magnify. Jared noticed the rocks had limbs, and that one of them was dragging what looked like a tow cable. Jared watched as they approached and finally arrived at the sled. One of them maneuvered itself in front of Jared while the other two attached the two cables. The rock was human-sized and irregularly hemispherical. Up close, it looked like a turtle shell without an opening for a head. Four limbs of equal length sprouted in quadrilateral symmetry. The limbs had two joints of articulation and terminated in splayed hands with opposable thumbs on either side of the palm. The underside of the rock was flat and mottled, with a line that went down the center, suggesting the underside could open. Across the top side of the rock were flat, glossy patches that Jared suspected were photosensitive.
"Not what you were expecting, Private?" said the rock, using Martin's voice.
"No, sir," Jared said. He accessed his internal database of the few intelligent species that were friendly to, or at least not openly antagonistic toward, humans, but was coming up with nothing that was even remotely like this creature.
"I was expecting someone human."
Jared felt a sharp ping of amusement.
"We are human, Private," Martin said. "As much as you are."
"You don't look human," Jared said, and immediately regretted it.
"Of course we don't," Martin said. "But we don't live in typical human environments, either. We've been adapted for where we live."
"Where do you live?" Jared asked. One of Martin's limbs motioned around him.
"Here," he said. "Adapted for life in space. Vacuum-proof bodies. Photosynthetic stripes for energy."
Martin tapped his underside.
"And in here, an organ that houses modified algae to provide oxygen and the organic compounds we need. We can live out here for weeks at a time, spying on and sabotaging the Oban, and they don't even know we're here. They keep looking for CDF spaceships. It confuses the hell out of them."
"I'll bet," Jared said.
"Okay. Strauss tells me we're good to go," Martin said. "We're ready to reel you in. Hang on."
Jared felt a jolt, and then felt a small vibration as the tow cable was reeled in, dragging the sled into the ring. The rocks kept pace, manipulating small jetpacks with their hind limbs.
"Were you born this way?" Jared asked. "I wasn't," Martin said. "They created this body type 3 years ago. Everything new. They needed volunteers to test it. It was too extreme to drop a consciousness in without testing. We needed to see if people could adapt to it without going insane. This body is almost entirely a closed system. I get oxygen, nutrients, and moisture from my algae organ, and my waste gets dumped back into it to feed the algae. You don't eat and drink like people are supposed to. You don't even pee normally. And not doing things you're hardwired to do will make you nuts. You wouldn't think that not peeing could prey on your mind, but trust me, it does. It was one of the things they had to find a way around when they went into full production."
Martin pointed toward the other two rocks.
"Strauss and Pohl, now they were born in these bodies," Martin said. "And they're perfectly at home in them. I tell them about eating a hamburger or taking a dump, they look at me like I'm insane. And trying to describe regular sex to them is just a complete loss."
"They have sex?" Jared asked, surprised.
"You don't want to screw with the sex drive, Private," Martin said. "That's bad for the species."
"Yes, we have sex all the time."
He motioned to his underside.
We open up here. The edges of our cowl conceal with someone else's. The number of positions we can perform are a bit more limited than the ones you can. Your body is more flexible than ours. On the other hand, we can fucking total vacuum, which is a neat trick.
I'd say so, Jared said. He felt the captain was veering into too much information territory.
But we are a different breed, no doubt about it, Martin said. We even have a different naming scheme than the rest of Special Forces. We're named after old science fiction writers instead of scientists. I even took a new name when I switched over.
Are you going to switch back? Jared asked. To a normal body?
No,
Martin said.
When I first switched over, I would have, but you get used to it. This is my normal now, and this is the future. The CDF made us to give them an advantage in combat just like they made the original Special Forces. And it works. We're dark matter. We can sneak up on a ship and the enemy thinks we're debris, right until the pocket nuke we stuck on their hull as we scraped by goes off. And then they don't think about anything anymore.
But we're more than that, Martin continued. We're the first people organically adapted to living in space. Every body system is organic, even the brain pal. We've got the first totally organic brain pals.
That's one improvement that's going to be passed down to the general special forces population the next time they do a new body edition.
Everything we are is expressed in our DNA. If they can find a way to let us breed naturally, we'll have a new species. Homo Astrum, who can live between the planets. We won't have to fight anyone for real estate then, and that means humans win.
Unless you don't want to look like a turtle, Jared said.
Martin sent a sharp ping of amusement.
Fair enough, he said. There is that, and we know it. We call ourselves the Gamorans, you know.
Jared fuzzed a moment until the reference came into his head, from back in the evenings at Camp Carson, watching science fiction films at 10 times speed.
Like the Japanese monster? You got it, Martin said.
Do you shoot fire, too? Jared asked.
Ask the Oban, Martin said.
The sled entered the ring. Jared saw the dead man almost as soon as they slipped through the hole in the side of Covel Station. The Gamorans had informed Special Forces that Covel Station was largely intact, but largely intact clearly meant something different to troops who thrive in hard vacuum. Covel Station was airless and lifeless and gravityless, although some electrical systems remarkably still had power, thanks to solar panels and hardy engineering. The Gamorans knew the station well. They'd been in it before, retrieving files, documents, and objects that had not already been destroyed or looted by the Oban. The one thing they didn't retrieve was the dead. The Oban still came to the station from time to time and might notice if the number of the dead dramatically reduced over time. So the dead remained, floating cold and desiccated through the station. The dead man was wedged up against a corridor bulkhead. Jared suspected he hadn't been there when the hole in the hull they slipped through was made. The explosive decompression would have sucked him right out into space. Jared turned to confirm this with Martin.
He's new, Martin confirmed. To this section, anyway. The dead drift a lot around here, along with everything else. Is that someone you're looking for?
Jared drifted toward the dead man. The man's body was parched and dried, all the moisture long since boiled away. He would have been unrecognizable even if Bhutan had known him. Jared looked at the man's lab coat. The name tag claimed him to be Uptold Chatterjee. His papery skin was green. The name was right for a colonist, but he'd clearly been a citizen of a Western nation at one point.
I don't know who he is, Jared said. Come on, then,
Martin said. He grabbed the railing with both left hands and propelled himself down the corridor. Jared followed, letting go of the railing on occasion to get past a dead body bumping through the corridor. He wondered if he might find Zoe Bhutan floating in the corridors or other part of the station. No, a thought said. They never found her body. They found hardly any colonist bodies.
Stop, Jared said to Martin. What is it?
Martin said. I'm remembering, Jared said, and closed his eyes, even though they were behind his cowl. When he opened them, he felt sharper and more focused. He also knew exactly where he wanted to go.
"Follow me," Jared said.
Jared and Martin had entered the station in the weapons wing of the station. Corward lay navigation and biomedical research. In the center was a large zero-G lab. Jared led Martin Corward and then clockwise through the corridors, pausing occasionally to let Martin pry open deactivated emergency doors with a jack-like piston. Corridor lights, fed by the solar panels, glowed feebly, but more than enough for Jared's enhanced vision.
"Here," Jared said eventually. "This is where I did my work. This is my laboratory."
The laboratory was filled with detritus and bullet holes. Whoever had come through was not interested in preserving the technical work of the lab. They had just wanted everyone dead. Blackened, dried blood was visible on tabletops and down the side of a desk. At least one person had been shot here. But there was no body.
"Jerome Koss," Jared thought. "That was the name of my assistant. He was originally from Guatemala, but immigrated to the United States when he was a kid. He was the one to solve the buffer overflow."
"Crap," Jared said. The memory of Jerry Koss floated in his head, looking for context. Jared scanned the room, looking for computers or memory storage devices. There was nothing.
"Did your people take the computers from here?"
he asked Martin.
"Not from this room," Martin said. "Some of the labs were missing computers and other equipment before we ever got a chance to swing through. The Oban or whoever must have taken them."
Jared pushed himself over to a desk he knew was Bhutan's. Whatever had been on the top of the desk had long since floated away. Jared opened the desk drawers to find office supplies, hanger folders, and other, not particularly useful things. As Jared was closing the drawer with the hanger folders, he saw the papers in one of them. He stopped and pulled one out. It was a drawing, signed by Zoe Bhutan, with more enthusiasm than precision.
"She drew me one a week, in Wednesday art period," Jared remembered. "I would take the new one and hang it with a pushpin, and take the old one and file it. I never threw any away."
Jared glanced up at the corkboard above the desk. There were pushpins in it, but no picture. The last one was almost certainly floating somewhere in the room. Jared had to fight off the urge to look for it until he found it. Instead, he pushed off from the desk toward the door, slipping out into the corridor before Martin could ask him where he was going. Martin raced to keep up. The work corridors of Covell Station were clinical and sterile. The family quarters worked hard to be the opposite. Carpeting, albeit of the industrial sort, covered the floors. Children in art classes had been encouraged to paint the corridor walls, which featured suns and cats and hills with flowers, in pictures that were not art unless you were a parent, and could be nothing but if you were. The debris in the corridor and occasional dark smear against the wall worked against the cheer. As a research head with a child, Bhutan received larger quarters than most, which still meant it was almost unbearably compact. Space is at a premium in space stations. Bhutan's apartment lay at the end of C corridor. C for cat. The walls were painted with anatomically divergent cats of all sorts. Apartment 10. Jared pulled himself down the corridor toward apartment 10. The door was closed but unlocked. Jared slid the door open and let himself in. As everywhere, objects floated silently in the room. Jared recognized some things, but not others. A book that was a gift from a college friend. Some picture in a frame. A pen. A rug he and Cheryl bought on their honeymoon.
Cheryl. His wife. Dead from a fall while hiking.
She died just before he left for this posting. Her funeral was on the second-to-last day before he came here. He remembered holding Zoe's hand at the funeral, listening to Zoe ask why her mother had to leave and making him promise he would never leave her. He promised, of course. Bhutan's bedroom was compact, Zoe's one room over, would have been uncomfortable for anyone who wasn't five. The tiny child's bed was shoved along one corner, so securely wedged there that it hadn't floated away. Even the mattress stayed stuck. Picture books, toys, and stuffed animals hovered. One caught Jared's eye, and he reached for it.